You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, February 29th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Bronwyn Dickey, journalist, contributing editor at Oxford American, and author of the forthcoming book, Pitbull, Battle Over an American Icon. We're going to be talking about Pitbulls, race, class, and everything that they represent in America. It's a fascinating book. Also, Bronwyn just got done going on a conspiracy theory cruise, where apparently these conspiracy theorists discovered some secrets about her along the way, while she learned that vaccines are destroying us all, Hillary Clinton's really a reptilian, and a lot of other interesting underreported facts. In a cruise ship, we'll get the inside info from her. Hopefully it won't be revealed that I'm on the Vatican payroll. Oh, damn, what? Sorry. Did not mean to say that publicly. Also on the program, Iranian reformists score big wins in parliamentary elections in that country. We're going to get into some of the details of that. Good news for President Rouhani and the reformist path there, or the pragmatic conservative path in Iran. Marco Rubio, the little man, is finally catching on and playing Donald Trump at his own game. He should have been doing this for months. It's too little, too late, but necessary, and a great implosion of the Republican brand. It's just beautiful to watch as they all devolve to Trump's level. They were already there to begin with. Now they're just trying a little bit more effectively. Not a good result for feeling the burn in South Carolina, but two big new endorsements for Bernie Sanders that were not expected. One of them was definitely not expected. And we'll look at how what Bernie has done can carry on regardless of what happens over the next coming weeks in the Democratic primary. And a whole lot more on today's Majority Report. How was everybody's weekend?
Mine was brief. I'm excited to have the leap day today, though, because it gives us another day to continue this national conversation that we're having politically. That's, I think, very important, and we need every day possible. So,
that was an extremely earnest weekend update from Matt and Kelly.
I had a good weekend, but I'm tired.
I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
I get it.
It doesn't seem to really... I had to go to Jersey, so like I was just telling Matt.
Jersey?
I was going to a baby's birthday party.
Oh, that's cute.
Well.
No? Not a cute baby?
Of course. Oh, my God. Of course. I think the baby should be a baby model, and then there was all these other babies, and they were adorable, and the whole thing's adorable, but it's in Jersey, so... No offense to everyone in Jersey. It just takes a long time to get there.
So. Not a cute baby, and Jersey sucks.
Don't you dare say that.
You heard
she
it here first.
She is a beautiful baby. I She really is.
I buy it. I buy it.
Okay.
I believe it.
That was my weekend. Jersey.
Really briefly, while we're on the subject of having extra time to cover this important election season, let's give you a little taste of the of how important this is and go to sound clip number one, where Donald Trump, I got to be honest with you, someone made a GIF of this, and someone tweeted this at me, and I watched this on repeat. Kelly could attest to this. I was here on Friday afternoon after the show doing some work and watching this thing on repeat, and I would be like,
it's not normal. He watched it 50 times in a row and didn't stop laughing.
I'm going to look at this again. So, and repeat. So let's look at Donald Trump, who was part of his Chris Christie endorsement, which is really just basically a roast of Marco Rubio, come out. And now with the Marco Rubio water material, he has stage props. Let's take a listen to this. You should be able to hear this, but if there's anything that you're missing, I'll explain to you what Trump is doing. So now Trump is waving a bottle of water around.
It's Rubio!
It's Rubio! And then he's splashing water into the audience now. And now, wait, pause it. I just got to say, and I'm sorry if you're seeing this visually because this is a disgusting impression, but he's taking the bottle of water and he's pouring it. It's capped now. And he's pouring it on himself and he's literally like biting the water. He's so thirsty. He's like... And it's his impression of Rubio drinking water. Okay, proceed. Then after that, you can finish the sound. He just tosses the bottle to the side like he's done. This
unbelievable.
I don't have anything to add to that. We'll be
it's
right.
really hard. It's really hard to understand how funny this is, and so I'll put a clip up on YouTube, and you guys, anyone who's listening, you have to.
You really have to go watch this.
I mean, it's peak Trump actually being funny.
Oh, it's really funny.
He's mastered the nonverbal gesture, and I love the way.
It's true. I've mastered the nonverbal gesture.
He says
it's a fantastic point.
He says unbelievable about something that he's doing, like unbelievable.
Unbelievable. This whole thing's a disaster. All right, we'll be right back with my friend Bronwyn Dickey.
Yeah, Rockefeller, we invite you to something epic, you know? Where we hustle out of a sense of hopelessness, sort of a desperation. Through that desperation, we come addicted, sort of like the fiends we accustomed to serving. Where we feel we have nothing to lose, so we offer you, well, we offer our lives. What do you bring to the table? Well, I'm watching me closely. My kids butter for the bread, they wanna toast me. I keep my head, both of them where they supposed to be. To get you sidetracked and clap from close feet. I don't sleep, I'm tired, I feel wired like codeine. These days a rubber gotta admire me. From four fiends away, my pain, wish it was quick to see. From selling cane to brains was fried to a fricassee. Can't lie, at the time it never bothered me. At the bar getting my dog on properly. My squad and me, lack of respect for authority. Laughing hard, happy to be escaping poverty. However brief, I know this game got valleys and peaks. Expectation for dips, for precipitation, we stack chips hardly. The youth I used to be, soon to see a million, no more. Big Willie, my game has grown, prefer you call me William. Illin' for revenues, grateful lemon like Channel 7 News, round 7 Jews, head dead in the mic. Forgetting all I ever knew, convenient amnesia. I suggest you call my lawyer, I know the procedure. Block my body, can't trap my mind easily. Explain why we adapt to crime. I'd rather die enormous than live dormant. That's how we own it. Live
at the main event. I better trip to Maui on it. Presidential suites, my residential for the weekend. Confidentially speaking in code since I sent you beacon. The NXS rental, don't be fooled, my game is mental. We both out of town, dawg. What you trying to get into? Viva Las Vegas, see ya later at the crab tables. Meet me by the one that starts a G up. This way, no fraud, Willie's present, gambling, they re up. And we can have a pleasant time sipping margaritas. G G G. Can I live? Can I live? My mind is infested with sick thoughts that circle like a Lexus. If driven wrong, it's sure to hurt you. Dual level like duplexes. In unity, my crew and me commit atrocities like we got immunity. You guessed it, manifested in tangible goods. Platinum Rolexed it, we don't lease, we buy the whole car, as you should. My confederation, detonation, explode on detonation. Overload the mind of the said patient. When it boils the steam, it comes to it, we all.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Bronwyn Dickey. She is a journalist, a contributing editor at Oxford American, and author of the forthcoming, soon-to-be-released book, Pitbull, Battle Over an American Icon. Bronwyn, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm great. I'm really happy to be speaking with you, and turning some of our offline our sort of off air chats into radio gold. So
all right,
let's make it happen.
That's a lofty goal.
I have no doubt that we can hit our marks here.
All right, make me look good.
It's not going to be a problem. You just got off of, and you have an article that's actually we're teasing a couple of things from you. We have the book that's coming out in May, which I've been reading an advanced copy of. It's great. We'll get to that. And you have an article coming out, I believe, in June, and correct me if I'm wrong, in Popular Mechanics on this conspiracy theory cruise that you went on. This cruise is like craziness that I cannot even sort of put into words. So why don't you explain first, what is this cruise, and how did you end up on it?
Right. Okay. So I actually think I came across it on a science blog somewhere, but it was kind of floating around the internet, and my editors and I discussed it because I'm very interested in science communication. I'm interested in belief formation, how people come together and talk about ideas, how evidence is evaluated, all kinds of things. And it seems like a really fun way to do that, since I think the latest research shows that over 50% of Americans believe some kind of conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. So while we can say that, oh, you know, that's crazy stuff and no one really believes that, when you actually do the polling, over half of us secretly kind of think that maybe the CIA was in on JFK, or the government covered up something at Roswell.
Our producer, Matt, is nodding his head so rigorously at this CIA-JFK thing. And he's got the look, too, of like, that's not a conspiracy. It's true. I just want to
well,
say...
that's the thing. We've all sat in our college dorms and talked about these things. But then when you kind of put them out there, you say, oh, these people are crazy, these people are nuts. And yes, some of the ideas are really wild and really out there. But especially with how we talk about science in the media now, especially in the media culture that we live in, where science has become just another part of partisan politics. Mm-hmm. I felt it was really important to kind of look at why people believe what they believe and how they come to hold these ideas.
So, okay, that makes perfect sense. And what you're talking about is like, you know, I mean, global warming is kind of the preeminent example of this, that something
exactly.
So that's a scientific reality. You can have a policy debate, I suppose, about how you address it, but it migrated from that to, well, I just don't believe the science of it. And then that actually migrated to, you know, there are these scientists, these researchers are getting big money off of the, you know, the global warming lie.
Absolutely.
So that's the kind of preeminent example. So what is this cruise specifically then, and how did you end up on it? And give us kind of like a tour of the insanity on display in this cruise. And then actually I'll maybe towards the end of the conversation, not exactly sympathy that I have for these people, but I think there's some context as to why this type of conspiracy thinking has so much currency. But start with the cruise itself.
Sure. So it was a 7-day cruise on Princess Cruise Lines.
Wow.
Which I don't know if
you're a committed journalist.
which was the official cruise line of the Love Boat. and it sails from Los Angeles down to Cabo San Lucas and back. Mm-hmm. And it was hosted by this small kind of spiritual travel company called Divine Travels. And there were only about 100 conspiracy theorists on the boat. And the rest of the boat was like 3,000 people just doing what they were doing in the casinos and the buffets and all that stuff. But what I kind of realized, and basically the whole thing was, you spend a week on this boat and you attend these seminars hosted by people like Andrew Wakefield, who is largely credited with kind of stoking public fears over vaccines, kind of the vaccine autism debacle that happened. Jeffrey Smith, who is, I think his former career was in yogic flying, but he's a leading anti-GMO guy now.
I'm pretty good at yogic flying.
Sean David Morton.
It's true. I'm fantastic at it.
Refers to himself as America's prophet and was indicted by the SEC for who alleged that he defrauded his investors by telling them that he could psychically predict the stock market with a technique he learned from Nepalese monks.
Oh, word. Okay.
Yeah. So
I'm just taking notes for some supplemental income ideas right now.
According to
Nepalese monks,
the IRS is a private corporation based in Puerto Rico, and that there is no real law that anyone has to pay taxes.
Right. Got it.
So basically, there are these seminars that you attend, and everyone was just kind of going about their cruise business. But what became apparent was that the setting of the cruise ship added to the general paranoia of the group, in that you have all these very small windowless spaces. Everyone feels a little sick, and you realize by the end of like day two that you're essentially in a nightmarish Liberace designed hotel with locked doors.
Oh my
God. That you can't get out of.
So
so
you're able to enter that type of thinking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just is very, the whole thing is very disconcerting. And when you're in a
Kelly is saying that you have
who
PTSD.
Are highly suspicious.
Right.
It makes you highly suspicious, especially as the tension kind of grows, which is what happened.
Do you have PTSD? Kelly wants to know.
let's just say that the day we disembarked from the ship, I literally skipped the entire way from the gangplank, saying all kinds of expletives, most of which involve the F word. I don't know if I can say that on your show.
You can say one.
I think the other journalists would back me up on the fact that I said, fuck this shit, all the way down the gangplank. And we went out to breakfast. There were like three other journalists on the boat. We went out to breakfast and we were all basically nonverbal. We just couldn't even. we could not even process the week that we had just had. But I do think it's important to say a lot of people in that group were incredibly nice to us.
Right.
Really nice, very welcoming. And they took a big risk having us there. So kudos to them, really.
Right. No, so before we get to maybe a little bit more of a serious question I have about it, I don't want to get into this in great detail, both because I don't want to reward certain behavior on the internet, and I also don't want it to be revealed that, you and I think we both know that money comes from many different sources, and there's a lot of shadowy influences that are lurking right now as we speak. But with that said, it was also revealed at one point on the cruise, and this is where, you know, the comic and the terrifying, because there was the notion that you were actually a plant for the pharma industry, and that's hilarious on one level. Also, it's really disturbing because of the things that have fallen out about that. So I just want you to, touch on that.
Yeah. So yeah, at one point, there were two presenters in the group, and I won't mention their names because I don't want to give them more attention.
Sure.
But they became convinced that because I wrote for Popular Mechanics, I must be kind of in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry, mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. Popular Mechanics is a science magazine, and they've written many articles about debunking junk science and how kind of what a menace junk science can be in the larger conversation. But they became convinced that Popular Mechanics, who's owned by Hearst, has some connection to the Lagardère Group, who purchased the Bataclan Theater and is some kind of relationship with Qatari Holdings. Therefore, I must be working for the Qatari government. I mean, I was never kind of clear what that was, but the
idea thought we'd
was
been really good about covering that up.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It was this very kind of weird illogical journey, but it became clear that kind of within that worldview, any disagreement can't happen unless you're a shill or a stooge or right. a puppet. Like there was no possibility that I might disagree with them because I myself had evaluated evidence and did not think their evidence was strong. I must be working for someone and plotting against them. So at one point they rushed to the internet cafe and printed up stacks of Popular Mechanics articles and handed them out to the other participants.
Oh my
and
God.
Tried to kind of shove them in my hands saying, look at this, explain yourself. And
did you
other
ever just...
people on the boat had to step in between us. It was a very ugly dust up.
That's really creepy. I mean, did you ever just want to sort of escape to the casino or Zumba class and get away from them?
Well, that was the thing. There was no real escape. Everything was kind of awful. So, I mean, where are you going to go? Am I going to go to Crooner's Bar or the Explorer's Lounge where they're having a Thomas Kincaid auction? Or
wow.
am I going to go to the Grand Atrium with the white piano and the people who are selling gold by the foot?
I would say chains? Yes at this point.
Or am I, you know, it's like, where do you really go? So, that was pretty ugly. I locked myself in my room at one point. And you just think, this is so absurd. Like, even I myself am acting in this absurd way. But when you are so far outside of reason's jurisdiction, mm-hmm. then you really don't know what's going to happen. And the last thing you want to be is in a conference room with no exit.
Oh, my gosh. Well, so, I feel... I don't know how I feel laughing about this. I feel really horrible.
But again, I do stress there were some incredibly nice, warm, welcoming people there. So I don't want it to, you know, come across that everyone was like that.
Oh,
but it was a very weird, weird incident.
Well, no, and this is actually my sort. I have like a kind of two-part, not defense of the conspiracy theorists, but maybe a complication. Because, mm-hmm. so as an example... I think of sort of two tracks with conspiracy theories. One, I think it's a reflection of we live in a really complex and exhausting world, and everybody obviously is always seeking pattern recognition and stories and whatever the story is, frankly. I mean, you know, some stories are more grounded than others, but even like the kind of ultra-rationalist nerdism narrative, that's a story too. I'm not being relativistic
Absolutely.
About, you know, one makes more sense than the other, but we're constantly seeking patterns. We're seeking stories to soothe our anxieties and contextualize our lives. So there's nothing special about
Very
that.
Very much.
And then the second part that I wanted to get your feedback on with both of these things is that, you know, like as an example, if you go to specific communities, like I remember several years ago, there was polling that came out on specifically African-American attitudes to HIV/AIDS conspiracy theories, or even, mm-hmm. you know, Thabo Mbeki, who's the former president of South Africa, who was a very, like, sophisticated and, you know, interesting leader and very globally respected. He came out and, you know, promoted the, you know, HIV/AIDS dissonance. And what was interesting
right.
is that in the process of those rants and those articles that he published, sometimes anonymously, included in that was very sharp and very real critiques of the pharma industry that were really sound and really grounded in reality, that it is a very exploitive and an extractive industry. Or when you look at AIDS conspiracy theories, you go back to the history and you look at like the Tuskegee Airmen and you go, oh, right, because there actually was this, there was a medical conspiracy that, you know, attacked African Americans. So, or, you know, or I think the, some of the conversations with GMOs, you know, that's a big thing that comes up on our show, because someone like me, like, no, I don't think GMOs are going to, like, you know, one drop gives you brain cancer or whatever. But I do think there's legitimate questions about, do you want a sort of intellectual property dominance of Monsanto in agri markets? I think that's a very real conversation. Right. So how do you sort of tease those things apart, you know, between that and just the junk?
Well, I think there's an important difference. One, you're absolutely correct in that, you know, there's a difference between conspiracy and conspiracy theory, in that true conspiracies and some very sinister, nefarious ones have happened. Tuskegee was real. The tobacco industry did cover up the, you know, the science about smoking causing lung cancer. You know, thalidomide, what that was real. I'm not sure it was a conspiracy as much as it was an accident or just lack of, you know, due diligence, but did happen. You know, Watergate, Iran-Contra, all these things really did happen. So in that landscape, it's understandable that people are going to be suspicious, especially of the U.S. government, who, you know, is at the top in terms of world power in most things. Also, the people who don't have, I guess, don't have access to kind of the levers of power in vulnerable communities, who don't feel they have as much of a say in the political conversation, and who have been grossly mistreated in the past, of course they will be more suspicious. That makes all the sense in the world, and they have reason to be. But with things like the kind of suspicion of Big Pharma, Monsanto, et cetera, what kind of happens is that social and political issues with the way these companies market themselves and how aggressive they are in the marketplace become conflated with scientific fact. Mm-hmm. So you may have, and I have big problems with the way pharma companies conduct themselves in the marketplace. I have problems with the way Monsanto conducts itself in the marketplace. Same thing that you were just saying about intellectual property and seeds and suing and all those things. But that's really separate from whether or not vaccines are an instrument of genocide or whether the credible science says GMOs are safe, or, you know, we use terms like safe because it's the limit of scientific knowledge at this point. Mm-hmm. But to conflate the social problems with these major corporations with scientific evidence is a huge mistake. You can have all the social problems you want with those companies, but the science has to stand on its own and has to be evaluated as science.
Right. Well.
Does that answer your question?
Well spoken, like a true pharma agent. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah.
No, I mean,
no, it totally answers it.
There are really good reasons to be suspicious. I mean, in the past, there have been issues with certain vaccines. The swine flu thing in 1976.
Right.
There was increased risk of adverse effects with that, and that's why we have vaccine courts and things. And so many people doing all this research today, thank God, DDT and whatever. That's why we have this whole movement of environmental scientists who can evaluate these things. So
it just all gets mixed up. It just gets all sort of mixed up in this kind of like souffle where you go from, you know, very legitimate criticisms. And I think even like... I think even having like a precautionary principle, which they used to have in the EU to some degree, is a legitimate policy perspective. And then it's sort of all of a sudden we're going to, and Hillary Clinton's a reptilian. And it all just sort of comes under the same umbrella.
Yeah. Well, also, I think if I can just make one more point about the kind of Monsanto Big Pharma thing.
Of course.
I think with any of these issues, the science is so complex and takes so much kind of intricate advanced knowledge to understand that the simple narrative that it's scary and dangerous is much easier to accept than trying to go through the finer points of immunology right. and, you know, vaccine trials or how plant breeding and plant genetics and genetic engineering actually work. Mm-hmm. And so the more opaque the system seems, and you see this with politics, people who don't really understand how the political system works or how journalism works. That was one thing that I was very amused by when people said, oh, well, you're just going to write whatever Hearst Corporation tells you to say or whatever. And I said, you know, obviously you've never been in a newsroom because right. you would know if you'd been there for 5 minutes that any journalist would take any opportunity to give the finger to their corporate overlords in like 2 seconds.
Right.
You know,
right. Like, they don't have a sense of the mechanics of how, you know, the last question I have on this then is, do you, I think you're absolutely right. And to a certain extent, like, I completely accept the fact that when it comes to something like, you know, some of these very specific questions about immunology or whatever else, like, I'm entirely flying blind myself.
Absolutely.
Do you think that
most of us are,
right? So then this sort of culture that's sprouted up, which I understand the frustration of people from scientific disciplines and scientific backgrounds being like, oh my God, there's so much garbage and so much nonsense, some of which has real effect on public health. But there's this sort of like, you know, this kind of like, well, actually sort of attitude, which is yeah. really, really off-putting and yeah. does not speak to what seems like, you know, it's an emotional narrative. It's not an intellectual narrative. So just sort of like, popping bubbles and scoring nerd points is not really going to address it.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. You can't reason people out of what they were not reasoned into. Mm. And unless you can kind of speak to their underlying fears with compassion and understanding and patience and kind of empower them with the proper information, you're just not going to get anywhere. They'll only become more entrenched. And there's a lot I think we can learn about communication from that. To be Definitely. Smug and dismissive, it really doesn't help anything.
Definitely. We're going to get to the Pitbull book. But I just want to say before we leave this conversation, I do think that the CIA gave Bob Marley cancer. I just want to be on the record with that. It's important.
Well, you know, I have questions. Yeah. Myself, yeah. I have questions about the death of Kurt Cobain, honestly.
No.
Well, I mean, everybody has a thing, right?
Of course.
Everybody has a thing.
You know what? I will say with Bob Marley, obviously didn't get cancer, but I think the initial hit on him, the CIA might have known about it. But regardless, I legitimately think that. so that's mine. And I will justify that at some later point. But this book, I've been really, really enjoying reading the advanced copy of it so much. It's called Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. And what's awesome about this book is it really gets to how dogs, first of all, they're co-evolutionary partners. So there's a whole sort of story about human behavior, how we project that behavior on nature. There's a biology story there. And then there's a story about race and about class mm-hmm. that is told through dogs. And I mean, I grew up with a Rottweiler. So I sort of have this sympathy and concern about like bans on certain breeds and stuff like that, which is how it can play out really mm-hmm. practically. How did you come to the pit bull story and then explain how actually even some of like the very terminology of race itself comes from dog breeding?
Mm-hmm. I kind of fell into it backwards. I had always been really afraid of pit bulls. And then around 2008, a couple of my friends had one and I met their dog and I thought, gosh, this is so not what I was expecting. I wonder how I came to have this story in my head about what pit bulls were and what pit bull people must be like. And then I adopted a dog, you know, that was labeled a pit bull in the shelter in 2010. And my experience with her was, again, completely different. But I saw that there was so much baggage kind of attached to her being a, quote, pit bull, that there were all these potholes I had to kind of navigate in society, whether it was people asking questions, making comments, having opinions, being afraid. Some people were incredibly fascinated, but it was, I had just never had such a kind of lightning rod experience. I didn't realize how much preconceived baggage, I guess, people brought to that conversation. So I became really interested in it, and I started researching it actually back in 2008 when I had the first experience. And then I just kept going and looking at how kind of thin the science was, how many memes.
In the science of like the dangerous pit bull. Yeah.
Right. How there was so little that was actually known, and it was just like a huge game of telephone, and it had just repeated itself over and over. But we had done this with different breeds. There's always been a different demonized breed, and it's usually, to speak to your later point, usually the demonized breeds have been kind of associated with a marginalized group of people, and that's played itself out over and over throughout the course of history. So there have been other panics, but none blew up the way the pit bull panic blew up, because no dog had been attached to kind of this intensely racial fear-mongering that blew up in the 1980s over urban crime and drugs and all kinds of political issues that were going on.
Yeah, you have an example, there are actually two examples from the book, and there's many, obviously. But one, you talk about the sort of early, off the top of my head, I don't remember the specific dates, but the sort of the New York City era of like Gangs of New York, I guess would be the pop culture reference, and how pit bulls were part of really brutal dogfighting rings. And what that symbolized in terms of the thoughts about Irish immigrants at the time, the thoughts about new people coming in from Europe, and, you know, they're dirty, they're criminals, all the rest. You tell this really disturbing, kind of amazing narrative about that, which culminates in a raid on this dogfighting ring organized at the behest of an aristocratic animal rights activist, which actually culminates not in these pit bulls being rescued and resettled, but actually killed. I mean, you want to explain that?
And that was actually the way that those busts were handled up until very recently. And I think that's a really good example of that era is a good example of how nobody is just one thing. So, you know, the animal welfare movement is something that I think most people would agree is a force for good in the world. You know, to move toward a more compassionate and humane society is a very good thing. So those early efforts were extremely important. But at the same time, they were products of that era. And the activists were products of that era. It was a very wealthy, white movement. And the people who were in charge of it had some very unfortunate ideas about animals relative to certain groups of human beings, such that there were political cartoons, actually, of Henry Berg, who founded the ASPCA in 1866. There were cartoons of him stepping over starving children so that he could, you know, save a horse or something
right,
like that.
So
all these things are kind of bound up together. And what your earlier point when you were talking about kind of the language of race and breeding and stuff, even the word race or race comes from the Middle French, and it was first used to talk about different types of hunting dogs and class them according to their nobility. So there was this kind of spillover ever since of basically the language of breeding and the language of human populations, which you saw kind of get most combustible in the eugenics movement, which was a very dark, dark moment in history.
Right. And then we'll touch just briefly on you talked about the 1980s before, when the pit bull, through articles in Rolling Stone and Sports Illustrated, became the sort of the dog embodiment of the Reagan era's terrors of urban violence, urban crime. and you quote these articles, which are, they're kind of stunning because they show, I mean, to some degree, frankly, like, you know, progress is long and hard, but I don't think that these kind of graphs could get published in Rolling Stone today as an example. But just these incredible, like, direct comparisons of, like, you know, a couple of Puerto Rican teenagers and their pit bulls that they go and fight. And the pit bulls are unusually violent and vicious as a breed, and so are the people.
Right, yeah. I mean, that was the implication. And I don't think, again, I don't think it was any kind of conscious prejudice on anyone else's part, but to show how very closely these ideas were linked. And all of this all assumes, I think you can appreciate this with all the discussions and debates you've had and the frustration that you feel over how people portray kind of Muslims as one group, when in fact they're an incredibly diverse group with tons of subgroups and other subgroups, sub-subgroups.
Right.
So it's kind of the same thing. And people took the idea of, quote, pit bull, which is not one breed, it's at least four. They were using it as a slapdash shorthand for kind of dog not otherwise specified, and they made it this vessel that they could put all their fears into about urban America, and it became this kind of culture war by proxy. And especially once people started kind of linking basically, quote, pit bulls to, quote, thugs and drug dealers and that kind of thing, it just became so explosive that it completely could not be controlled anymore. And the reality underneath all that was, it's a hugely diverse group of dogs. The people who love them was a hugely diverse group of people. And even though there were these sub pockets where some really horrible, nasty stuff was going on, the larger picture was that these were normal dogs and their people were normal people. And this idea that they were something supernatural or extra or terrifying was all in the imagination.
Right. And then that's how science kind of, you know, becomes junk science as well. And that sort of loops back to the earlier part of the conversation. As a final question, and I really can't wait. This book, I think, is coming out in May. Is that correct?
Yes, maybe.
Yeah, and there's a link on the website for people to pre-order. You also touched on, and I'll get your sort of brief description of this before we close, these new movements in animal rights that are sort of integrative, that they look at their role as, you know, if an animal is, as an example, chained all day, it's less usually a reflection that their owner is like a bad person and more that they have limited resources and don't really have an ability to sort of care for the dog in the way they would really like to. So that instead of just saying, like, oh my, you know, we got to get this dog away from these bad people, these activists are looking at it as, let's take care of the dog, let's take care of the community, and let's really help sort of build an economic infrastructure around animal care, which of course has implications for care of people.
Absolutely. They very much go together. Even evolutionarily, the dog and the human are kind of their own dynamic unit, and you really can't focus on one without helping the other. And so there are lots and lots of groups and nonprofits that are starting now that are looking at things more holistically and looking at the people and their pets and trying to help them both. And I think that's going to be probably the future of animal welfare for creating a safer and more humane community for all of us to live in. Because if there's one thing that I really did learn from this project, it was not the narrative that you hear in the media that everyone hates pit bulls and there's something scary about them. Not at all. I found people are so in love with these dogs. They're probably more in love with them than they've ever been. And if you only listen to this tiny white suburban segment of the population who's never experienced them and is afraid, you're basically saying all these other people don't count.
Right.
And so I hope to kind of widen the aperture a little bit and invite people to think critically about all stereotypes.
You absolutely do. And so the article is going to be in the July issue of Popular Mechanics, and you got a taste of the horrifying conspiracy cruise. And the book is Pitbull, Battle Over an American Icon. That's coming out in May. We have a link to it on their website for the pre-order. Bronwyn Dickey, you sounded really good. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half, where I also, full disclosure, I love pit bulls, as well as Rottweilers, as well as pretty much all dogs. I'm just a sucker for dogs. Are awesome. Join us, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Write a review for us on iTunes. Majority Report Kickback, Jet.com. That's the socially responsible Amazon. You get 15% off of your first purchase. Give it a try. And if you're using Amazon, take a little skim off of them and give it to us by using our Amazon link. It makes no difference to you, only a difference to us. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade, tea, coffee, and chocolate. It's a win for everybody. We get a lot for you in the fun half, so we'll get to it. See you.